Well, good morning, church. It is great to see you here at the end of 2019. It's been just a great way to close out the year, I think. I just really appreciate it. I appreciate Tommy's leading us in worship this morning and songs that are familiar to us and new to us. Really encouraging. I loved seeing Chad bring Xander up here. I was really inspired. I wanted to carry Jonathan and Addison, but they texted back that that was not going to happen. But that was great. And then David's devotional thought for the Lord's Supper was just really powerful and on point. I thought it was a really good time of us being together and worshiping and remembering. And this is the last Sunday of 2019, which and it's our first look at the new year, at 2020. 2020. So you know what that means. That means that, of course, across this nation and in thousands of pulpits this morning, there are going to be preachers and pastors saying, "I'm Barbara Walters, and this is 2020. But you're too smart for that. You're a little sophisticated, so I'm not going to do that to you. Because for one, you've probably figured out that I am not Barbara Walters. And so that brings us to the real heart of this lesson, and that's dealing with a problem that has affected some 14 million people over this past year. And that's identity theft. So quick poll this morning. How many of you, let me finish the question first, but how many of you have had to deal with someone stealing your identity or using your credit card to make unauthorized purchase or being scammed by someone pretending to represent, say, the government or IRS or some other agency? How many of you that's happened to you ever? Just raise your hand. Wow, y'all are gullible. No, I'm just kidding. It's happened to me. I've had my card stolen, number stolen a few times. And when someone asserts that they are someone that they really aren't, when they do that, we recognize that there are some pretty serious problems and consequences kind of arise out of that. You know, if someone opens up an account in your name and claims to be you, well, it places a burden on you that you shouldn't have to bear, right? You're not the one who spent that money or opened that account. Or when someone pretends to represent, you know, a government agency or the IRS or your computer company or software company, if you believe them, then they cost you thousands of dollars fraudulently, right? So I think we can all agree that the world would be a better place if we just followed this one principle, if everyone would just own their own identity. Agreed? Everybody just be whoever you really are. The strange thing about Jesus in Mark's gospel is that for most of Mark's story, Jesus kind of skirts this question. I mean, he doesn't lie. To be clear, Jesus never lies. He's never deceptive in any shape, form, or fashion. That's not what I mean. But at the same time, he largely just kind of avoids this question of who he really is. And so as far as we know, in reading through Mark's gospel, Jesus has only revealed his identity to really a handful of people, a very select few. He never, ever, ever, ever in Mark's gospel announces publicly who he is. He never says, you know, it's me, Jesus Christ, or I'm the Messiah, or I'm the King, or I'm the Son of God, or anything. He always calls himself the Son of Man, which is kind of a vague title, which was used by the prophets. And so there's these hints, but he never just outright says it. And so now we've come here to the end of Mark's gospel story, to the kind of the high point, the main focus of Mark's entire story. He spends like a third of his entire gospel dealing with these last few days of Jesus' life. He's just drawing it out and getting so much out of it. And Jesus has already been arrested, right? He did the Last Supper with his disciples, and he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. He's been arrested. He's been questioned before the Sanhedrin. We've gone through all of that. And remember, the Sanhedrin was the ruling body of Jewish leaders. You've got the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. And these guys hate Jesus because he's upsetting the apple cart and they're afraid of what he might say or do that would rob them of their power. And so they're trying to find something. They're charging him with anything that'll stick. They're throwing everything at him, hoping something will stick, hoping they can find some way to have him killed. And what they finally decided, we read in his trial before the Sanhedrin, was that they accused him of blasphemy. Used the Son of God of blasphemy, which is ironic. And this isn't even strictly true. We talked about what it meant to blaspheme, and you know it's not true. Jesus didn't commit blasphemy. Jesus knew he didn't commit blasphemy. And even his accusers knew, strictly speaking, that Jesus had not committed blasphemy. But that was the best evidence they had. That was the best thing they could concoct against him. But that leaves them with a really big problem in trying to deal with Jesus. Remember what Israel's political state was at this point. They are a state of the larger Roman Empire, an occupied state. So you've got, you know, a Roman garrison right there, right beside, built, almost added on to the temple. It's so close. And you've got Romans centuries placed throughout the land and throughout Israel. And it means that the Romans are really in charge. And so Roman officials are the only ones who can condemn someone to death. I mean, you don't really have the power to authorize someone being killed if you're Jewish. So the Roman officials are the only ones who can put a criminal to death. So now these Jewish officials have to convince their Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, to do just that. They've got to get Pontius Pilate to convict Jesus of a crime that will get him killed. But the charge is blasphemy. Pilate does not care about blasphemy. That's just a religious law, right? It would be like going to the government and saying you were, you know, just say, for instance, that you really believe the only version of the Bible people should use is the King James Version or the NIV or whatever your favorite is. Like, you just really believe this is the best version of the Bible, and go into the police station and say, I have this guy who is using the New King James, and it is a terrible version. I need you to press charges against him, right? Well, the police station would laugh you out of the house. They don't care about your religious codification. So Pilate doesn't care if Jesus has been blasphemous. That's not breaking any Roman law. So there's no way Pilate is going to condemn Jesus to death for committing blasphemy. He doesn't care about that charge at all. So the leaders of the Sanhedrin, they get together, and Mark just kind of alludes to this, but they get together, they come up with a plan. They're like, okay, we know he's committed blasphemy. And then they say, but we can't get Pilate to do anything about that. So instead, we're going to think up a charge that will really get Pilate's attention. What really will get Pilate's attention is if we tell him Jesus is claiming to be the King of Israel. If Jesus is claiming to be the King of Israel, that's a big deal. You see, in the past, there'd been all this unrest in Israel. And they'd had rebellion against the Roman government. That's why the Roman government is there now in such strong force, because it has been just a hotbed of political anti-Roman activity. And so if someone's coming along claiming to be King of the Jews, he might be building an army to fight back against Rome. So they're like, that's what we're going to say. We're going to say Jesus is claiming to be King of the Jews. Normally, Pilate would not be here, by the way. Pilate does not live in Jerusalem. Pilate has a big palace, the Roman governor's palace. It's in Caesarea. But, again, because of Israel's history and because of the way they fought back against the Roman Empire, during certain times of the year, Pilate sort of made a circuit. And he would ride around to places they thought trouble might be about to get stirred up. So being in Jerusalem during the Passover makes total sense. During Passover, you've got high nationalist feelings because that was the time that they remember that God had overthrown their Egyptian overlords and set them free from oppression. And so now here they are. They're on. They're celebrating the Passover. And there are a lot of people who are thinking, you know, we need to kick Rome out. God needs to overthrow these oppressors, and Pilate's there to make sure that doesn't happen, right? He's there to make sure that nothing gets out of hand, nothing gets stirred up. So he's left his palace in Caesarea, and he's come to Jerusalem. And he's probably staying in the palace of Herod. Some people think that he might have stayed in that Roman garrison, but that would have been like an army barracks. No way is the governor staying in an army barracks. He is staying in the best possible place, the king's palace, the praetorium. And this is where the case is brought against Jesus. This is what we read. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the scribes and the teachers of the law and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. "You have said so," Jesus replied. It's kind of a confusing passage, but there's so much subtle irony in this passage that we need to break it down for just a second. First of all, Pilate asks Jesus if he's the king of the Jews while he is standing in the king's palace. This is some of the ruins of Herod's palace, and you can see this was a magnificent structure. So here is Pilate. He's standing in the king's palace, Herod, who is at least the king in name, and he's standing in this palace and in this opulent setting, and he's looking at this poor nobody of a beaten peasant of a man, this no one from some backwater village in the middle of nowhere in the boondocks, and he has to be wondering, is this poor guy delusional? I'm standing in the king's palace and you're claiming to be the king. Right? That would make no sense at all. But that's the irony here. Are you the king of the Jews? Because I've been standing in your house for some time, right? And then, second irony, Pilate gets the title wrong. It's real subtle. You may not have even noticed the difference there, but the title was supposed to be King of Israel. You can go through the whole Old Testament and you'll never find anybody who is the king of the Jews. Never happens, right? Because you aren't king of a people, you're king of a land. And so the king is the king of Israel or the king of Judah, depending on which period of Israel's history you're in. But Pilate takes all these charges that are being brought to him. They're coming against Jesus saying all sorts of stuff. And he gets the two Jewish titles, Messiah and King of Israel. And he puts this Gentile spin. He sort of just mashes those two things together. And what he comes up with is King of the Jews. The King of the Jews. And that's the title that's going to follow Jesus all the way to the cross and then to the grave. Remember, it was the sign above Jesus' head on the cross that said, Jesus, King of the Jews, right? Not King of Israel, not Messiah, King of the Jews. And what's more, those titles, they're meant to be like an insult, right? They're meant to mock Jesus, to make fun of Jesus. Because here is this guy dressed in rags, beaten and bloodied, and he's been, you know, even before this, he's been walking all over the place like a poor beggar, and he's been teaching people in the middle of nowhere, and he's obviously not a king. The idea is that this guy could be king. That is absolutely ludicrous, right? And that makes no sense at all. It would be like walking, you know, down the road today and coming up on a construction worker on the side of the highway and asking, "Are you the president of the United States? You're working on United States property. Are you the president of the United States?" Now, even in our modern society, our democratic, progressive way of thinking society, we know that's never the case. Because blue-collar workers are not the presidents or kings of anything. Right? Kings are a breed apart, literally. They have money and they have power and they're rich and they have powerful friends. And Jesus doesn't have any of those things. None of those things. At least not in the political sense. He doesn't have that sort of power, right? So are you the king of the Jews? It's just all mixed up. And finally, the last irony is that throughout Mark's gospel, Jesus has been avoiding this question, are you the king, right? And we really, in most of the story, we're wanting Jesus to say, like, who are you? You want Jesus to say it out loud and be like public and open about it. But now here's his life on the line. And now that his life's on the line, now when it really matters and we want him to avoid the question so that he'll live, now Jesus comes right out and says, you have said so. He just admits it. You have said so. Which is, again, you have said so is a straightforward answer. He is saying yes, but in a really weird way. You have said so. If we were to try and interpret maybe Jesus' words, it might be something along the lines of, that's true, I am the king, but your idea of kingship is really different than my idea of kingship. Or yes, I am the king of the Jews, but that doesn't mean what you think it means, right? Because Jesus never claimed to be the political king. He never wanted to live in Herod's palace and tell everybody what to do. That was never Jesus' design. That was not his mission. But through his suffering and through his death, he became the king not only of the Jews, but of all the nations, right? He becomes the king not of a physical land, because that was never his desire. He becomes the king of all the people. So in this crucial moment, even when he is faced with the prospect of his own death, Jesus claims his own identity. He owns his own identity at this critical point. And here we sit, we're thousands of years and thousands of miles removed, and we're facing that same sort of question. Now, not in the trial sense, but we have to answer the question, are you who you claim to be? One of the really big difficulties that we have in our culture, and this is not true all over the world, but it is true in our culture, particularly in the part of the country that we live in, is that the majority of the people that we live with and work with and we encounter in the community, most of those people claim to be Christians in at least some sense of the word, right? I mean, you can hardly find anyone anywhere who doesn't claim some form of Christianity. You know, some may not be a part of a church or read the Bible. Some may not have committed their lives to Christ even, or pray, or live by any moral standards. It may not be any of those things, but in their minds at least, they are still Christians. What that means kind of varies depending on who you ask, but in their minds, they're still Christians. But what's more troubling than that to me, that doesn't bother me nearly as much, and I don't think it's the point of what Jesus is doing here. The point that's more troubling to me is that we might do all of those things. We might, you know, go to church and read the Bible and pray and put money in the plate when it comes around, but never really give our lives to Christ. That's the real question of identity this morning. Earlier in Mark's gospel, Jesus was accused by some Pharisees. They were like, "You're not teaching your followers the real law. You're not getting them to follow the law the way everybody knows you ought to keep the law," especially regarding the washing of the ritual washing of hands before they ate. And this was his reply, quoting from Isaiah. Jesus, he says, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me." In other words, there is a striking difference between honoring God with your mouth and honoring God with your life. There is a big difference between the two. And Jesus did not come to this earth, descend to the earth, and live and walk among us and die a cruel death on the cross so that people could one day stand up and say, "Yes, I follow Jesus." That is not what he came to do. Jesus came and did all of that so that we might actually follow Jesus. His goal was not to get more people saying they follow Jesus. His goal was to have people actually following him. And yes, it is difficult. It is not easy to follow Jesus. No one has ever made the claim that is follow Jesus. At least no one that I think would be truthful would say that it's easy to follow Jesus. Following Jesus is really difficult, right? Because he lived a sinless life, and he was self-sacrificial, and he laid down his life on behalf of the world. All of that is really hard. And so you're thinking, I can't follow Jesus. I can't follow Jesus. And I love this passage from the Gospel of John, or the very beginning of his gospel. He says, "Yet to all who did receive him, to who believed on his name, he gave the right to become children of God." Not to be named children of God, not to say they were children of God, but to become children of God. Not in the generic sense like everybody's God's children, but in actually becoming the son of God and the daughter of God. He gave you that right to become the children of God. And I don't know if you're into making New Year's resolutions or any of that. Like David said, odds are we'll make some, we might keep some, and we'll probably forget some along the way. And there are some good goals out there, whether it's regarding your health or your finances or your relationships. There's some good things that we can be doing. No doubt about that. But this is a goal that I think is really worthy of your pursuit this year. And it's not a big leap. But as we walk into 2020, the goal would be for you to be who you already claim to be. To own your own identity. Because already you are a son of God and a daughter of God. This is not asking you to be something you're not. You're being what God made you to be. You, like Jesus, will stand before the world and boldly make the claim, I am who you say I am. And it's true. Not because you're doing it perfectly, not because you have got it all down and you perfectly understand the Bible and you don't ever mess up on your morals or you don't ever make mistakes or you don't ever go back on promises or any of that. That's not what makes you a child of God. What makes you a child of God was the one who stood up and said, yes, I am who you say I am. Because Jesus is who he says he is, you are who you claim to be. And this morning, if you are ready to become a child of God, Jesus has already said, I have done that and made that possible for you. But for most of us this morning who are already Christians, who would already own that name Christian, and we at some point in our lives we have committed our lives to Jesus Christ, and we have come to church, and we take the Lord's Supper, and we sing these beautiful songs, and we go home, maybe we read our Bibles, and we pray, and we do those good things, at least in part of our lives, the encouragement is to own that fully and let that just spread throughout our lives. Not only our lives, but in the lives of our homes and in the lives of those we work with and live with and share community with. And if we can help you with that this morning, we want to encourage you to do that. Won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?